Hello, and welcome back to Paleocast. I'm Joe.
And I'm Liz.
And today we'll be talking about the evolution of echinoderms and the development of five-fold symmetry. But first, we've got some exciting announcements.
At the end of May, we have Progressive Paleontology, which is a one-day conference for early career paleontologists. So it's mainly PhD students and master's students. And Paleocast will be recording all of these talks live on May 22nd. So we'll have them going live and also recorded afterwards. So if you want to check out those talks as they go, you can check out our website and see them live.
Will you be doing a talk, Liz?
Unfortunately not, because I'm helping to organize this with the University of Southampton. I'm going to be running around being a crazy organizer for the day. So no talks for me, but I think you're giving a talk, Joe.
Yeah, I'm doing a talk, so you can listen to me rant on about boring dead fish to your heart's content. So have we any other news for fossil fans?
This weekend, actually, we've got the Lyme Regis Fossil Fest as well. Hopefully Dave Marshall will be able to make it there and do some recordings for Paleocast. So if he's there, take a look for him. He'll be wandering around in his Paleocast shirt. Otherwise, if he's not around, I'll also be there with the University of Southampton, but won't be doing any recordings because I'll be too busy with a bunch of little school children. So we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, so if you are going to the Lyme Regis Fossil Festival, there's a chance you might see a very tired Dave Marshall, our very own Dave Marshall, back from the rigs to chat to about paleontology. Today I'm talking to Dr. Imran Rahman, who is a research fellow at the University of Bristol.
Hi Joe, nice to be here.
Nice to have you. So what exactly is a research fellow?
Yeah, so a research fellow is a very lucky chap like me who's been awarded money to carry out work on essentially what would be their dream projects, I guess. It happens after you've completed your PhD and you devise a proposal for the sorts of things you'd like to work on at that stage, which may or may not be related to your PhD work. And then you apply to different bodies, and if you're successful, then they give you a bunch of cash to do lots of exciting experiments. And so my current research is focused on the origin and early evolution of echinoderms.
Okay, and what exactly is an echinoderm?
Yeah, so I guess the term might not be familiar to everyone, but if I say the word starfish and sea urchin, that might kind of bring a bit more context to it. So echinoderms are actually a remarkably successful and diverse group of marine invertebrates. There are around 7,000 species alive today, and they have very extensive fossil record. And all modern forms are kind of characterized by three important features. And the first of these is their hard mineralized skeleton, which is composed of calcium carbonate. And that's something which distinguishes them from almost all other, well, many other organisms. Another feature which is not unique but very unusual for echinoderms is their five-fold symmetry, which basically means that they can be divided into five roughly equal parts. And that's obviously something which we can't say for many other animals. It's completely different to what we have, which is bilateral or mirror plane symmetry, where we're divided into two parts. So it's a very unusual feature. And the third feature which defines echinoderms is something called a water vascular system. And this is a complex system consisting of many internal canals which connect tube feet. And again, if you think back to the starfish, that's perhaps something where you might imagine what a tube feet looks like. And this water vascular system is used for feeding, locomotion, and waste transport and things like that.
So you mentioned their tube feet. What exactly do you mean by that?
So if you think maybe about a starfish, you can imagine one, a kind of iconic form with five arms coming off from a central part. And each of those arms is on the lower surface of each of those arms are a series of tube-like structures, which we call the tube feet. And basically, there's loads of them underneath the animal, and they're used for almost all of its important functions, especially locomotion, moving the animal around, but also feeding and for moving waste products and things like that around as well. And this is a characteristic of all modern echinoderms.
So are modern echinoderms ecologically diverse, or do they have many different life habits?
Yeah, so modern echinoderms, as I sort of alluded to before, are a remarkably diverse group, even though perhaps you've not heard of all of them. So I've already mentioned starfish, and that's possibly the most famous group of modern echinoderms, and they're all of these animals are marine, but these starfish live on the seafloor and they're fairly mobile. They can move around and they have a range of different life habits. Some of them can be predatory and they can also feed on particles on and in the seafloor. So they have a variety of feeding modes. And as I said, they're all characterized by what we call fivefold symmetry, which can mean that they have five arms, but it's not always the case. Aside from starfish, we also have a number of other groups. So we have sea urchins, which are quite spiny in many cases, and you'll know them if you step on them while you're going scuba diving or something. It can be very painful. Apparently, they can be a delicacy in certain countries to eat sea urchin gonads, which is something that I should probably do at some point in my research career. But again, like starfish, they have a variety of modes of life and can be predatory and they can feed on particles within the sediment and are quite mobile. Another slightly different group are the sea lilies or crinoids, which are quite common in the fossil record but relatively rare in the modern environments. And they have rather different modes of life. Possibly modern forms are slightly more mobile, but certainly in the geological past we think that they were fairly stationary. And they attach to the seafloor and feed on particles floating through the water fairly passively. They don't really kind of capture them in any active way, unlike some of the other groups. So those are three groups. There's also brittle stars, which are somewhat similar to starfish, but a bit more delicate looking. And there's the sea cucumbers or the holothurians, which look kind of like big slugs, really, and rather different to the other groups. But fundamentally, they still possess the same body plan. They still have this fivefold symmetry imprinted in key parts of their anatomy. They still have a hard skeleton, and they still have this water vascular system for feeding.
So check back to the website and I'll put up a photograph of each of the major groups of echinoderms for you to have a look at. So you mentioned there that some of the echinoderms, the starfish and the sea urchins, are predators.
Hmm.
When I see them on the beach, they're usually just stationary. How on earth do they catch prey and what do they eat?
Well, they can be a lot more mobile under the water than on the beach, with being as they're marine animals. And I guess if you see them on the beach, you might see them in rock pools, but when they're underwater in their natural environment, they're certainly a lot more lively. It all comes back to their sort of feeding system again. And so for example, with starfish, as I mentioned, they've got these arms which are covered in tube feet, and they can use those arms to capture prey. And if you look on YouTube, you can find videos of this happening. For example, I think I saw one on YouTube of a starfish capturing a fish, even. So they can eat almost anything if they put their mind to it. And they sort of would bring that towards their mouth, which is at the central part of the body. And sea urchins in a similar way, although they actually have a very specialised central feeding structure called Aristotle's lantern, which they can use to crush relatively hard organisms. So this gives them a sort of predatory function.
Okay. So what are the closest living relatives of echinoderms?
So the closest living relatives of echinoderms look really rather different to them. They are a group called the hemichordates, and hemichordates consist of worm-like forms and also some colonial forms. And unlike echinoderms, they lack a hard mineralized skeleton. Again, unlike echinoderms, they lack fivefold symmetry, and they are instead bilaterally symmetrical. So as I was saying before, they can be divided into two roughly equal parts. And that's something which is more common with other animals. They also possess gill slits, which are a structure which you might conceive of seeing in a fish, for example, which is another thing which we don't see in echinoderms. However, we know that they are closely related to echinoderms because if we look at their embryos and their larvae in particular, they're pretty much identical, and this is something which is very strong evidence for a close similarity. Beyond that, if we also look at the genetic makeup of these two different groups, we see a number of different similarities, and this has allowed scientists to relate these what would seem to be two rather different groups closely together. And this sort of begs the question of whether perhaps these animals were more similar in the past. Maybe echinoderms, for example, look more similar to hemichordates than they do today.
Okay, so I guess the way you would answer that question is to look at the fossil record.
Yes, exactly.
So do echinoderms have a good fossil record?
Yes, I think they have a pretty good fossil record compared to a lot of other groups. This is predominantly because they possess a hard mineralized skeleton, as I said, composed of calcium and carbonate. And because they're hard-bodied, this means that they're more readily preserved in the fossil record than soft-bodied organisms, such as worms. And as I was saying with the hemichordates, there's a lot of worm-like forms there. And so their fossil record is relatively poor compared to the echinoderms, which have this hard mineralized skeleton. And there are a number of specimens of echinoderms which are broken or badly preserved in various different ways. And these are still important. But if we're lucky, we can find these complete articulated specimens. And by articulated, I mean that all the plates, all the skeletal plates are connected together. And if we find individuals like that, that can tell us a lot about the early evolution and the history of the group.
Okay, so what is the oldest fossil echinoderms that you can find in the geological record?
Well, echinoderms are great, and they have a great fossil record, as I said, and thus they sort of date back to the first fossil appearances of animals, really, which comes in the Cambrian period over 500 million years ago. And in fact, the first echinoderm remains start to appear in at the same time as this event, which we call the Cambrian explosion, where we get the origin of all complex animal forms apparently appearing relatively suddenly in the geological record. And so we have deep in history, we have all of these different echinoderms occurring. And from the very beginning, we see a diverse range of different forms. So from their first appearance in the Cambrian, we don't just have conventional modern-like species, we also have very weird and wacky things.
If you have multiple different kinds of echinoderms appearing simultaneously in the Cambrian, does this suggest that there's a missing fossil record?
So I guess this is a big question, which comes back to how we see the Cambrian explosion in general, because we have all of these forms appearing approximately at the same time. We might expect that there would be some lead up to this, some sort of missing history. And echinoderms are no exception to that in a way. That, as I said, we've got all these forms appearing almost at the same time. So the question of whether there is some sort of missing history is one that's been heavily debated for many groups, including echinoderms. And I guess there's two kind of ways of seeing it, whether we don't have the fossils because there's not the rocks aren't there, or because we haven't found them yet, or whether their fossils aren't there any earlier than this because they simply weren't around and we got this relatively explosive radiation of different forms. Certainly if we read the fossil record fairly faithfully, we would start to think that that's the latter of those two is the case, in that we get this relatively rapid radiation of forms, and obviously there should be some missing history, but not an extensive missing history. And certainly given that echinoderms have this hard mineralized skeleton, which makes them readily preservable as fossils, we would imagine that all forms with a skeleton might appear in the fossil record almost as soon as they evolved. So I guess the missing history, and if there is one, perhaps could relate to the part of echinoderm ancestry before they evolved a skeleton.
So if I were to go and find a fossil echinoderm from the Cambrian, how would I go about studying its anatomy?
Well, there's been a number of techniques applied to echinoderms, and it sort of depends on the preservation of the fossils. So particularly within Europe, a lot of echinoderms are preserved actually as mould, so as air, within rock. So we don't have the original skeleton, we have the hole where it used to be. And one of the great ways that scientists have used to study these kind of fossils is with latex casts, where they fill in these holes with latex, which hardens, and then they can study these casts, which are sort of like a good representative of what the original fossil would look like. A lot of fossil echinoderms, particularly from North America, are preserved in a different way, where you do actually have the fossil skeleton, or at least some sort of secondary product of that. So you have this hard skeleton, and to study that, we can obviously look at the outside of that if we're able to free it from the rock. The problem with all of these fossils comes if we want to look at features inside them, because the only way to do that is to smash open the fossil or to slice it open in some way. And that can be problematic, particularly when we're dealing with very old and ancient remains, which could be one of a kind or certainly very rare. And so it's something we don't really want to destroy. And so another approach, which has started to be applied more recently, is to use X-rays to non-destructively peer inside some of these exceptionally preserved fossils. So one of the approaches I've taken, and a few other of my colleagues, is to use CT scanning, which is a technique which you might be familiar from in hospitals, where X-rays are basically fired through an object in order to give pictures of the inside of it. And because we're dealing with fossils and not living organisms, we can use very high-powered X-rays, which give us really nice pictures of the inside of these fossilized organisms. And that tells us something new about their internal structures, which we didn't really know about before. Taking that a step further, we can use a particular type of particle accelerator called a synchrotron to generate even brighter, higher flux X-rays and get a much better and higher quality picture of the insides of some of these fossils. So this is a great way of studying their anatomy. Building on these kind of anatomical reconstructions, we might also like to think about the function of some of these weird and wonderful animals, particularly those which are rather different to anything we have today. And so we can use computer models, for example, taken from engineering, stick in the data we have from a CT scanner into one of these computer models and simulate water flowing past one of these extinct animals and see what that tells us about how adapted they were to water currents, for example, in the past.
Okay, so you mentioned there that you need high energy X-rays to look at the anatomy of these fossils. How come you can't just take it down to the doctor's surgery and whack it in their X-rays?
Well, I guess it comes down to the difference between fossils and human beings. And we're fairly soft and squidgy, and fossils are typically very hard. And so that means that they are very dense and heavily mineralised. And so we need to use relatively high energy X-rays in order to penetrate through the fossil. And that's different to what the case with the human being, where we can use low energy X-rays because we're soft. And also we need to use these lower energy X-rays because it can be potentially dangerous to use higher energy ones. The other thing about CT scanners in a hospital is that they're for relatively low resolution imaging because they're normally looking at larger objects. And particularly with the sorts of fossil I'm interested in, which can be quite small, centimetre-sized animals, we want to get as high-resolution images as possible to see some of the fine structures.
Okay. And you mentioned there that some of the echinoderms are preserved as moulds. Mm. What happens to the original skeleton?
So essentially, it dissolves away. And there are different ways you could form a mould. For example, you might have your animal, which has died and is lying on the sea floor. And different parts of sediment could be attracted to this, and you could end up forming something called a nodule. And then later on, the skeleton would be dissolved away. And this leads then to a moldic fossil. And there are similar ways that can form, if not necessarily with a nodule, but just with the fossil being buried in layers of sediment. And so we don't have the original fossil anymore, but we do have a very faithful representation of it. And in fact, these moulds can potentially even be later infilled by different minerals. So you have even sort of more layers of complexity to the preservational history of the fossil.
Do fossil echinoderms tend to look like the modern groups?
So some do and some don't. There's a great diversity of different forms of fossils. There are some even from the very beginning, which look rather similar, and they have many of the features of modern echinoderms, such as this fivefold symmetry I was talking about, and also seemingly the water vascular system. But there are other forms as well, which look rather different. So all of these fossils, I should say, have the hard mineralized skeleton, but many of them possess quite different symmetries. So there are forms which have bilateral mirror plane symmetry. There are forms which are very asymmetrical, so they don't show any clear symmetry. Some of which look like shoes and things like that, and tennis rackets and all sorts of weird and wonderful things. And then there are some other fossils which have threefold symmetry. So they can be divided into three roughly equal parts. And I guess one of the key questions when you're studying these sorts of fossil organisms is, how do they relate to one another, and subsequently how do they relate to modern groups? Because they look quite different to, a lot of them look quite different to modern forms, but they must have some kind of relationship. So one of the key questions for paleontologists, and a kind of paleontologist in particular, is working out how the different fossils are related to one another.
Okay, so leading on from that, what characteristics do the earlier echinoderms share with the modern groups?
Yeah, so echinoderms, as I've said already, the fossil ones, they possess this mineralized skeleton, which is a key characteristic of all modern echinoderms. So that's one important feature that even the earliest fossil forms possess. But they also display a number of characters which are not seen in modern echinoderms, but do occur in other modern groups. So the symmetry, this bilateral symmetry, for example, which we see in some fossil echinoderms, is something that is seen in many modern animals, including their closest living relatives of echinoderms, the hemichordates. As I mentioned before, also hemichordates possess something called gill slit, and that is a feature which we believe we can identify in some of these early fossil forms as well. And some of the earliest fossil forms have this interesting combination of features which we see in modern echinoderms, but also features that we see in modern hemichordates and in other modern animal groups.
How did these extinct early echinoderms live?
Well, as with all extinct organisms, it can be very difficult to work out exactly how they live. But we can start to say some things based on similarities with modern forms, whether those be modern echinoderms or other groups. So there are a number of forms which look very much like the sea lilies, like the crinoids, which I mentioned earlier. They are different, and they possess a slightly different anatomy, but the overall similarity suggests they had a fairly similar mode of life, which would be probably attaching to the seafloor and feeding on food particles passing through on water currents. Some of the other forms, some of the more bilaterally symmetrical or asymmetrical forms, are rather different to modern echinoderms, and so it can be harder to think of how exactly they might have lived. But some of these forms have what looks to be like an anchor-type structure, which suggests that perhaps they were using that to keep themselves stable on the seafloor, and maybe feeding similarly on food particles that were passing by in water currents just above the seafloor. There are other fossils which were probably more mobile, and these might be similar in some ways to what we see with starfish and sea urchins, not necessarily to the same extent of predatory behaviour, but certainly being able to crawl along the seafloor and pick up small particles in the sediment and feed on those. And even beyond this, there might have been certain fossils that were burrowing organisms. And this is, this is a mode of life which we see in some modern sea urchins, and also in modern hemichordates. So burrowing through the sediment and feeding on particles within that. And often we have these hypotheses, and in order to test them, we need to do some sort of additional analyses. And this is one of the reasons that things like computer modelling could come in handy.
Okay, so you mentioned earlier about virtual models to simulate the effect of these animals in water currents.
Mm-hmm.
Would this be a way to investigate how these animals lived?
Yeah, definitely. So I think if we can look at different fossils and examine how well how much drag they produce, so for example, how well adapted they are to different flow velocities and flow currents, that could tell us something about whether they would have been able to live in these very high high flow regions or whether they might have been better off in more sheltered areas. We can potentially try to look at the strength of different attachment structures which might have been used to keep the animals fixed to the seafloor. And again, that might tell us something about what sort of environments they were living in, whether they were very high energy, high velocity environments or lower energy environments. And all of this data, the great thing about these computer models is we can easily repeat them, we can change certain parameters, so we can change what type of fossil we're using in that quite easily. We can change its orientation, we can try different sorts of current velocity and things like that. And of great importance as well is that we can actually experimentally test some of these computer models. So we can take our 3D fossil, print it out, and stick it in something like a physical flow tank, and then look at the flow past that and see how that compares to the computer model. And if we get a relatively good match between the physical model and the computer model, then we can be fairly confident that our computer model is realistic.
Have you got any 3D printed echinoderm fossils?
Yeah, I've got a few. So relatively recently, I took one down to some facilities in Leeds and stuck it in a nice flume tank there. And I think they were then possibly was a bit unusual for them. They're more used to engineering things. But I think they enjoyed it. And so we have a few printed models based on CT scans of these fossils, which are great for science, but also for public outreach and education as well.
And Christmas presents?
Possibly Christmas presents, yeah.
So we know that modern echinoderms are very different to their close relatives, the hemichordates. Does the fossil record help us understand how the body plan of modern echinoderms actually evolved?
Yeah, so this is one of the key questions really in echinoderm paleontology, is working out how modern echinoderms have evolved their five-fold symmetry and where these early fossil forms fit into the story. So we have a lot of fossil forms which have different types of symmetry, and as I mentioned already, there are certain forms which are bilaterally symmetrical. And one hypothesis is that this bilateral symmetry is something which was present in the ancestor of all echinoderms, and that the fossil forms which also show this feature are very, very primitive forms, very close to this ancestor. Possibly then we can take that a step further and think, how do we go from something with this kind of bilateral symmetry to something with fivefold symmetry, and try to piece in the position of the asymmetrical fossils, or those which have threefold symmetry. And we can think about what sort of transformations might have been necessary to go from something like a bilaterally symmetrical fossil into an asymmetrical fossil, or even a threefold symmetrical fossil. Probably something would have had to happen during its development, which often isn't preserved. But at the very least, if we can work out how these different fossils are related together, we might be able to say something about the evolution of characters from the ancestor of all echinoderms to modern echinoderms. One example of this is if we think about gill slits. So I mentioned that gill slits are, or at least we think that gill slits might have been present in some early fossil echinoderms, but are not present in any modern echinoderms. So if we're able to work out the position of the fossil echinoderms that possess these gill slits, we can say that subsequently this character must have been lost in the evolution of the echinoderm body plan. And this tells us as well that these gill slits, because we know they were present in the ancestral forms, were lost after this hard mineralised skeleton had been acquired.
Can you speculate why echinoderms might have lost their gills? Gill slits, sorry.
I guess it would have been something to do with their mode of life changing. And certainly this is one explanation people have proposed for many things that are weird and wonderful about echinoderms, is that they have a somewhat different mode of life to other animals, and certainly a different structure. And perhaps they no longer needed gill slits for respiration, because in modern chordates and hemichordates, gill slits are used predominantly for respiration and also for feeding. But perhaps the water vascular system, which evolved in echinoderms, and perhaps it evolved relatively late in the group for all we know, perhaps that replaced gill slits in terms of the function. But this is, I should say, fairly speculative, and it's rather an open debate that's still going on.
So judging by the diversity of living echinoderms, and we've already mentioned that these are an ecologically diverse group, can you speculate as to why five-fold symmetry has been so successful?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really quite tricky question because it's not a symmetry which is particularly prevalent in the animal kingdom. It's a very unusual thing to see. And so it has been suggested that it could be potentially associated with shift in feeding mode of echinoderms compared to other organisms and or some other aspect of their ecology. And that it might also, again, relate perhaps to their water vascular system, which is this relatively unusual or even perhaps unique way of feeding and respiring and performing various basic functions. But I think it's tricky to answer also because we don't fully understand exactly how we got to fivefold symmetry. So as I said, we know that primitively echinoderms should have had bilateral symmetry, and now the modern forms have fivefold symmetry. But to go between these two radically different structures would have been a number of different transformations, which might have been, or probably did involve changes in their development, which are rather difficult to study in the fossil record because they're not normally preserved. And there will have been other important changes even in the adult anatomy. And so I would say that before we can really answer exactly why fivefold symmetry has arisen, we really need to answer how it's arisen. And the fossils will play an important part in that.
So I guess we need to still work out the change from a superficially worm-like thing and the stepwise changes leading to a star-shaped thing.
Exactly, yeah.
Are there still questions that remain unanswered concerning the origin and the early evolution of echinoderms?
Well, I certainly think there are many questions, and many of them relate to how we study and how we interpret the fossil forms. And certainly I've presented kind of my particular interpretation of these fossils, but there are many people who look at them in different ways, and they would say that perhaps these things which are bilaterally symmetrical aren't primitive, perhaps they're really derived, so that they had originally fivefold symmetry and then later lost it. And so there's these debates which are ongoing about how we look at these fossils. And I guess the main thing for addressing these is just to obtain more data, really. And obviously that can mean finding new fossils, but it can also mean finding new information about the anatomy of the fossils we already have. And we can do that by using some of the modern techniques that I discussed, such as CT scanning. And then once we have as much information about the anatomy of these fossils as we can possibly get, the idea really is to try and work out how they're related to one another. So what similarities are there between the fossils, and how does that help us work out where they sit on a evolutionary tree? And this is a big goal of the Echinoderm Tree of Life project, which is ongoing in the US at the moment. And they're attempting to work out how all the various different fossil forms relate to one another. And once we have a more robust or rigorous picture of how Echinoderm fossils are related to one another, this is when we can start to do the really exciting things. So looking at the evolution of their body plan, how different features were acquired or lost, and in what order. And so I think that framework is essential before we can sort of move on to the next step. We can certainly speculate as to the origin of things like fivefold symmetry now and why it was important. But until we can be truly confident about the phylogeny, about the evolutionary history and relationships of these animals, we're not going to get so far.
So to keep it very topical, just recently they announced that a new discovery of a Cambrian fossil locality that shows soft-bodied preservation. Are you excited that there might be some early echinoderms in this deposit?
That obviously would be fantastic. I think it's interesting to note that in a lot of these exceptional fossil deposits, things like the Burgess Shale, you do see some echinoderm fossils, but you never see them with soft tissues. So if we were able to find some of these fossils with their soft parts preserved, that would be fantastic, because that would tell us about, well, certainly it would tell us more about their anatomy, but it would also answer some key questions about what characters they possess. Did they really possess gill-like structures, for example, or not? Or did they possess other internal organs which are similar to things like hemichordates, or were their organs more similar to what we see in modern echinoderms? And so finding fossil echinoderms in particular with soft body preservation would be absolutely magnificent, and I hope that it does happen, but we're still looking anyway.
Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Paleocast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with Joe Keating and Laura Soule. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, with music supplied by the Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at paleocast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.